This is Matt from the Splatterhouse, and you're listening to Tale of the Manticore.
The following podcast is intended for a mature audience. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome back to Tale of the Manticore, Season 2. Like the creature from which it takes its name, Tale of the Manticore is a mashup, a crossbreeding between two different species of storytelling. Here, you will find the unpredictability of old-school RPG paper and dice games with the storycraft of a dark fantasy novel. No character is sacred, and no character will be spared if the dice decide their fate is at hand. According to lore, the tail of a manticore is barbed with cruel iron spikes. There will be much pain in the days ahead. Last time on Tale of the Manticore. Chapter 61 begins what is essentially a dungeon crawl through Whitestone Castle. The companions have been brought here and let in by the former captain of the Royal Guard, Sindwan, or Greenblood, as the PCs know him. For now, they all have the same goal: find out what happened here and discover whatever became of King Kulfrey. In addition to a dungeon crawl, there's also an element of cat and mouse. The castle is haunted by a Yethhound, the accursed Krell, and it might be anywhere in the castle, although it avoids any rooms with natural light during the day. Led mostly by Yellowfly, the companions find a great hall, a dining hall, Kulfrey's throne room, a waiting room, and finally, a library. There's a mangled corpse in the waiting room, and the library contains some evidence that shows a pursuit preceded the killing. The companions can't tell who or what the assailant was. Their best guess is that it was done by a starving guard dog. Chapter 62, Part 1, Day 183, Morning. Party status: Yellowfly, 39 of 39 hit points. Shawnee, 30 of 30. Jace, 37 of 37. Catsbane, 17 of 17. Bazu, 16 of 16. Spells available: Catsbane has memorized Magic Missile times 2, Invisibility, Mirror Image, Haste, and Slow. Bazu has prayed for Cure Light Wounds times 2, Bless, and Silence 15-foot Radius. Shawnee's heart skipped a beat when she stepped through the broken door and almost walked right into a suit of scale mail armor. For one crazy moment, she thought she had run into Sir Patrick Salamar, but after the initial shock subsided, she relaxed her shoulders and smiled inwardly. The thought didn't even make sense. Yellowfly was wearing the defeated knight's kit. Of course, it was only a suit of display armor on a stand in the middle of the room. As she had suspected, this was not part of the Great Hall, but rather some kind of hub with doors on all four sides. It was not inelegant, but it lacked the ostentatious grandeur of the rooms they had just passed through. The only features here were the suit of display armor and a coat of arms on the wall of painted wood. The Imperial Crest was a heater shield shape divided into four squares. The top left and bottom right squares were black, while the other two were green. Two of the other three doors were closed. The exception was the one opposite them. The door to Shawnee's left was oversized and bordered by carved wooden scrollwork. She was fairly certain it would connect to the Great Hall. Thinking she had run into Salamar, or perhaps his ghost, made her think of the Goddard Estate, and that, in turn, made her think of the twin marble stairs leading up to the second story. Shawnee was willing to bet there would be a similar set of stairs in Whitestone's Great Hall, and if they were looking for Kulfrey's chambers, that was probably the best way to go. She began moving toward it while the others filtered in. Behind her, she could hear Yellowfly asking Catsbane how long dead he thought the corpse had looked. The mage offered 1 week as a guess.
Well, hopefully that starving dog is dead or gone by now.
We can't be certain it was a dog,
Catsbane pointed out.
What else could it be?
Yellowfly returned.
The Emperor King of Camranth was said to keep a bear for a pet, I have heard,
ventured Bazu, joining the conversation.
Pah, I'm sure that's just a silly rumor,
Yellowfly scoffed.
Don't be so certain. And besides, could a dog have broken through this?
Bazu indicated the unhinged door behind them. Yellowfly looked back over his shoulder and shrugged.
Maybe. I don't know.
I think we should go this way,
Shawnee interrupted. She quickly explained her theory that the oversized door should lead them to a set of stairs. The others agreed, especially after Catsbane explained that the open door opposite them was the only way the murderous animal could have gone. The argument was compelling enough that Yellowfly crossed the room and shut the door.
"It doesn't lock, but it's better than nothing, I suppose," he muttered. "All right, Shawnee, lead on."
He rejoined the group as Shawnee grasped the handle and pushed. It's extremely unlikely that this door will be locked, but I suppose that at least now and then I should roll for it. I think a 1 in 6 chance of it being locked is about right. A 1 on a d6 means it is. The roll. I got a 4. Shawnee's guess turned out to be right, and the door opened to reveal the western end of the Great Hall. Jace's lantern did not throw enough light for her to see all the way to the opposite side, which they had crossed on their way into the dining room. From here, she could tell that all the decor was the same as it had been at the eastern end. Portraits of various sizes filled all available wall space. All down the length of the hall, pedestals half recessed in the wall supported busts. End to end, the great hall easily spanned 200 feet, perhaps more. Looking to her left, she saw the double door leading to the waiting room, still closed. Opposite, the southern wall had a closed single door, and, further up, an archway. She moved towards the closest door. It had a carved wooden facade, depicting a forest scene. The handle was brass and shaped like the head of a deer. She was aware of a faint sour odor, but it might have just been the stink from the corpse in the waiting room. At that moment, Jace stepped up behind her with his lantern, followed by Yellowfly. When he saw Shawnee about to open the door, he waved his hand in prohibition. She lifted her eyebrows in response, prompting his explanation.
"Unless there's a way to the second floor behind that door, it's of no interest to us, Shawnee. Now, you believe that the stairs are further down this hall?"
The rogue nodded at him.
"All right, then leave the door be. Curiosity killed the cat, you know."
Shawnee shrugged and took her hand off the handle.
"I thought he killed the cat," she said with a lopsided grin and looking past Yellowfly's shoulder.
Catsbane had just entered the hall, followed by the cleric.
"Right. Well, we need to keep moving. Take us to your stairs, Shawnee."
She did, going down the hall first, jogging a little ahead of the others and trying to move without making too much noise. It was a wasted effort. Her companions were making what seemed to her like a racket with their jingling armor and heavy steps. As she went, Shawnee passed a half dozen busts of supposedly great men and women. She didn't recognize a single one. What was so special about being born rich? She hated all nobles, but royals were the worst of the lot. She poked one of them in the eye with a gloved finger as she went by. Not far up ahead was the archway. She stopped and waited for Jace and his light to catch up. Unfortunately, if their footfalls didn't give them away, his light would. It galled her to move so conspicuously, but they needed to see, so it couldn't be helped. When the fighter caught up and her field of vision expanded, she could see that she'd been correct. There were indeed twin curving stairs here, exactly like the ones in the Goddard Estate. No, she corrected herself. The stairs in the Goddard Estate were a copy of these ones. The empty space of the open archway was between them and the stairs, and she needed to make sure that there was no threat beyond them. By habit, she flattened herself against the wall and tilted her head past the corner, just enough to see what lay beyond. She saw nothing but an empty vestibule, so she motioned to the others that it was safe to proceed. Jace took this opportunity to move past her and take the lead, holding his lantern high in his left hand and letting his right linger by the hilt of his sword. A couple things need to happen before I can proceed. Firstly, I think it's time for another wandering monster check. I'm not exactly sure 2 turns have elapsed since the last one, but the PCs are approaching a central space in the castle, where, the PCs are about to find out, an encounter has already taken place, somewhat recently. We'll learn what that's all about soon, but first, let's find out if the Yethhound will figure into the next scene. A 1 on a d6 means it will. Rolling. A 5. The party is safe for now. Whew, that's very good news. And I have more good news. Today is a level up episode for Jace, who becomes a 6th level fighter. He gets a d8 for new hit points. Oh, a 7 on the die. With Jace's constitution bonus, that brings his new total up to 45. Amazing. Let's hope for continued good luck as we roll for potential stat increases. Strength. I've got a 5. Nothing there. Intelligence. A 4. How about wisdom? Another 5. Dexterity. A bump here would provide a very valuable +1 to Jace's armor class. A
Alas, I rolled a 2. Constitution. I've got a 4. Charisma. Last chance for an increase. A 1. Ugh, the luck has run out. Still, I'm not disappointed. That hit point roll makes up for all. And what's more, Jace's proficiency bonus is now at a +4. Pretty good. Can't complain. Alright, let's take a quick ad break. When we return, we'll find out what the pieces discover at the stairs.
Dungeon Dads is a podcast of 4 dads.
John.
Tim.
Sam.
And me, Tom, playing an epic game of D&D. But it's really a story of 3 mismatched heroes. Jonas Silverwind, a highborn wizard.
I am going to cast Mage Armor.
Abel Rockbrother, a wayward cleric.
Tempest, will you please, in your infinite wisdom, help me to kill these men?
And Filnir Omajira, a warlock who's made a pact with a higher power.
I owe it my life. I guess you had to be there.
Come for the epic adventure.
This army of barbarians in fur and leather, they're rushing the war wagon.
Stay for the dad jokes.
So, here's the whole, fellas.
So, quoth the queen.
And 80s references.
People are people, so why should it be that you two should get along so awfully?
Find us at DungeonDads.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Hey, not bad. Can we do one more take where you pretend like you actually like the show?
Yeah.
Chapter 62, Part 2, Day 183, Morning. Party status. The party status is unchanged, with the exception of Jace, whose hit points have increased to 45 out of 45. Jace didn't have either hand free to make the thieves can't sign that there was danger ahead, but the look he threw over his shoulder communicated as much. Seeing it, Shawnee and Yellowfly drew their blades, while the others prepared themselves for trouble in their own ways. When they traveled the short distance to the fighter, they saw what he saw. The 200-foot length of the Great Hall was bisected by an open space containing 2 massive sets of crescent-shaped white marble stairs. Shawnee recognized them as the inspiration for the still impressive but lesser pair at the Goddard House. As in the other estate, a statue stood inside the embrace of the stairs' curves. It was a 15-foot-tall, robed woman whom they all recognized. This was Vesaluna, the mother goddess. On the statue's far side, and midway up the stairs, were a number of bodies. Some were sprawled across steps alone, others were piled on top of each other. There was dark, dried blood everywhere. It was in greasy smears on the walls, soaked into the stairs' green carpet runners, and splashed on the balustrade. It even flecked Vesaluna's expressionless face. At a glance, they could tell that all of the bodies belonged to City Watch guards. They wore the same uniforms that Lord Rabbit had once provided to Yellowfly and Tamlin for their infiltration of the tower, green and black tabards over suits of boiled leather. These men had all carried swords and, uncharacteristic of the City Watch, round wooden shields.
"They've been ripped apart," whispered Shawnee.
She was right. The guards weren't just dead. They had been mutilated. Even their leather armor had been shredded.
"These must be the men of Koch's scouting parties. The ones who never returned,"
Catsbane whispered back. Yellowfly's left hand was free. He used it first to signal for silence, and then to direct Jace to watch the closest stairs. Shawnee, he motioned to watch the eastern wing of the Great Hall. Bazu and Catsbane were assigned to guard their backs, since the vestibule and the room with the deer head door had been left unexplored. He took it upon himself to inspect the bodies, and did so. After a few minutes, he returned and called the others into a huddle. His face was troubled, and he cast concerned glances up the stairs every few moments as he spoke.
"There's a trail of blood going up to the top, but there's no way a guard dog could have done this. Well, maybe a whole pack of dogs, I don't know. The bodies have been fed upon, like the courtier. So I hope that whatever did this might have starved to death was in vain. The only good news is that these guards have been dead for days. Jace, I think you ought to let Catsbane carry your lantern. Then you, me, and Bazu should each take a shield. I'm not looking forward to meeting this animal in a fight, but we need to be ready for it. We might be one step closer to solving the mystery of what happened here."
Shawnee suddenly turned to Catsbane, who was accepting Jace's lantern. With her free hand, she pointed at his chest. It had just occurred to her that the rust monster he had once provided them had come from Whitestone.
"Your master didn't keep anything up in his tower that could have done this, did he? Some monstrosity or other that might have gotten free."
Catsbane shook his head no.
"I don't think so, Shawnee,"
he whispered back.
"Not unless he kept creatures I never saw."
Judging by Shawnee's scrunched up expression, she was not convinced.
"Come on, We should keep going, said Yellowfly. He led them up the stairs in single file. As they passed the scene of the massacre, Yellowfly, Jace, and Bazu each selected a shield, pulling them free of the dead men's grips and fixing them to their own arms. I've always thought that shields should afford more than a +1 to armor class, but I suppose realism in D&D is a slippery slope once you get on it, so I'll stick with the rules and update the applicable armor class scores by a single point. Since we're on the topic, here's where everyone currently stands. Shanae, who does not take a shield, retains her leather armor and dexterity bonus AC of 14. Catsbane also keeps his AC of 11 for a dexterity bonus and no armor. Jace wears Shral's gifted chainmail +1, and now adds a shield for a new AC of 16. Bazu wears Jace's old chain hauberk. His new shield gives him a 16 as well, because he enjoys a modest dexterity bonus. Finally, Yellowfly's armor class also becomes a 16. He doesn't have a dexterity bonus, but he is wearing Sir Salamar's suit of scale mail. These are modest improvements, but I have a feeling that the PCs are going to need all the help they can get. The Yethhound isn't far away. I can feel it. Going from the bodies all the way to the top of the stairs and beyond was a trail of dried blood from corpses, likely more than one, that had clearly been dragged away. Yellowfly counted 5 bodies on the stairs, so he guessed there had been 7 or 8 to begin with, and this only accounted for one of the scouting parties. Bazu's theory about the bear was beginning to seem more credible. He reached the top of the stairs and peered cautiously in either direction. It was dark here. The slit windows set into the south wall were shuttered and admitted no light, so he was forced to rely on the lantern, now held by Catsbane, close behind him. It threw his elongated shadow against the opposite wall like a specter as he crested the final stair. To his right, a short length of hall connected the two stairs. An archway in marble with a garish leaf motif marked the halfway point between them. Further on was a second arch, much more modest and simple in design, leading off into the gloom. Yellowfly thought that if he were to open the shutters and look out the windows, he might be able to see the main doors of the castle. He briefly considered doing so, but then thought better of it and decided instead to rely on lantern light. To his immediate left was a third arch. Through it went the trail of dried blood. There was a carpet in the hallway beyond that ran down the center. Blood had soaked into it in puddles and smears. Yellowfly squatted down. He had just noticed a shape on the carpet. It was a half a boot heel. He was certain of it. That would suggest that at least one of the guards had been alive up here, and moving away from this position. The back of the heel was nearest him. He scanned the floor for other clues, but there was too much blood, and he discovered nothing. Yellowfly sighed. He had a choice to make, and he was not sure what to do. They could follow the blood trail, or they could move away from it. Their mission was to discover what had happened here, and what had become of King Culfrey, but that did not necessarily entail having to fight some fell creature. Yellowfly had no desire to meet whatever had created this much carnage. The thought that there was a crazed bear lurking somewhere in the castle was not a comforting one. He gripped his shield tighter and steeled his resolve. Better they hunt the animal than it hunt them. He led the others east under the closest arch, walking on the flagstones beside the carpet so he didn't have to tread through the mess. The blood trail led down the length of the hall as far as their light source allowed them to see. Jace's lantern gave them 30 feet of good light and an additional 30 of dim beyond that. Yellowfly thought the blood trail looked as though it went that full distance. It did, and more. But after 50 feet, they came to a door in the north wall that looked at first as though it had been hit repeatedly with an axe. Great gouges of wood had been torn away and pulled down in parallel lines. It wasn't an axe. This had been done by claws. Jace was right behind Yellowfly, regarding the deep scratches and biting his lip. He remembered the enormous paw prints in the snow from his trip with Endwag. If the King of Camranth had kept a bear as a pet, might not Culfrey have kept a wolf? It would have to have been some enormous wolf. The scratches reached up as high as his shoulder, and they bit deep into the wood. Bear, wolf, or dog, whatever had done this was big, heavy, and very strong. There was dried blood on the handle, but Yellowfly gripped it anyway. He squeezed, and the latch lifted, but the door did not move. Barricaded on the other side, he whispered. Should he enlist Jace's help in forcing it open? He was fairly sure he knew what they'd find on the other side. One or more of Koch's patrolmen had fled here and blocked the door. If all this had taken place days ago, there wasn't much chance they were still alive. Furthermore, it would make a lot of noise to try to get this heavy door open, if they could even manage it. No, it was better simply to continue. Bazu must have divined Yellowfly's thoughts, because as the fighter turned away, he said,
Yellowfly,
If there is any chance that someone is behind this door, we must try.
I disagree. If anyone's there, they're lost.
But we must make sure of it.
The cleric persisted. Yellowfly dropped his shoulders and capitulated.
Well, we've already moved the door and made a noise. If anyone's alive in there, they'll be listening to us intently. I'll knock and then they should know we're no animal. Agreed?
Bazu nodded. Yellowfly rapped on the door, very softly, with his knuckles. Bazu gave him a stern look, and Yellowfly sighed before knocking again, slightly louder this time. He winced as he did it. There was no answer.
Happy?
Bazu just pursed his lips by way of response.
Grunted the other man. Good. Let's keep going.
Yellowfly's instinct that there was a risk involved in making noise is correct. Even though they didn't make very much sound, the castle is practically silent, so his knocking could potentially be heard at a distance. Another wandering encounter roll is the cost for their gamble. A 1 on a d6 means the Yethhound will hear the knock. Rolling. Still lucky. I got a 5. Catspain touched Yellowfly on the shoulder, stopping him before he could continue down the hall. In a hushed tone, he said,
"There could be something useful in Carrick's tower that might help if we were to run into..."
He gestured at the scratches in the door.
"Aye, what kind of something?" asked Yellowfly.
"There is, well, at least there used to be, a powder in Carrick's laboratory that causes torpor. It might still be there."
"Can Carrick's tower be accessed from the second level? I have no desire to retrace our steps," said the fighter.
"Yes, it can, though I don't know how to get there from here. Of course, the tower is to the west."
The trail of blood Yellowfly was set on following led in the opposite direction.
"What do you think, Bazu?"
"Catsbane's magic has saved us on more than one occasion,"
he offered sagely.
"Jace, Shawnee, your thoughts?"
Jace agreed readily with Bazu, while Shawnee said she was fine with going in either direction.
"All right, we'll go the other way. This hall doesn't look like it would lead to Colfrey's rooms anyway."
It was true. Compared to the grandeur of the marble stairs and the landing at the top, this hall looked bare and utilitarian.
"There may be other things of use in the lab, or in Carrick's rooms above,"
added the mage.
"We'll see," was all Yellowfly said by way of response.
He left the blood trail behind in reverse direction, returning to the top of the stairs. From there, they could go straight or to the right. The first choice took them under an archway similar to the one they had just passed through. The second had the gaudy leaf motif and led north.
"This way looks more, I don't know, majestic," said Yellowfly, walking towards and then under the decorated arch.
The landing was wide enough that they could walk two abreast, so Jace moved up alongside Yellowfly. Behind them came Bazu and Catsbane, who held the light. Shawnee hung back a little, in the rear. Thus arranged, the companions entered a T-shaped room, situated directly above the great hall of the first floor, and which might have been said to be a more modest copy of the other. In the stem of the T, a quartet of pedestals supported busts of Camertine's first four rulers, though only Catsbane and Bazu recognized them as such. Closest was square-jawed Murok the Conqueror. Then, moving counterclockwise about the space, came Lunin, his eldest, then Murok's daughter, Adeleth, she of smooth brow and fine features, and finally Bertram the Wise, son of Adeleth, and grandson to Murok. The four faces of Yor stared at each other from the respective corners of the square they implied. Between the pedestals and on the floor was a woven rug of green and black, shaped like a diamond. The companions were relieved to see that it was free of bloodstains, though the blank, pupilless eyes and collective frozen gaze of Camertine's founding monarchs was unsettling in a different way. Yellowfly motioned with his hand that they were going to take the left side, heading west. They were now in the top bar of the T. The walls here had been painted a shade of coral pink. The ceiling was painted as well. Some artist had been commissioned to create the illusion of a blue summer sky with errant clouds and even birds flying high above their heads. As below, the walls were crowded with portraits. One of them, Catsbane noticed with distaste, was of Lady Bellegrette, the child author of his bygone misery. In it, she wore a white dress and a cherubic smile. Her blonde hair was tied up with a green ribbon, and an emerald sparkled from a choker at her throat. Catsbane could not help but sneer as he walked by. Thank you for listening to Tale of the Manticore. If you enjoy the show and would like to help to support it, there are lots of ways to do so. You can recommend it online or to friends. You can like and repost episode announcements on social media. You can pick up One Shot in the Dark, the Pendulum World Building Tool, or Encyclopedia Manticorica on DriveThruRPG. And finally, you can rate or review the show on your podcatcher of choice. Thanks to everyone for their support of the show. At this time, please allow me to share one of your very kind reviews. This one is from Apple Podcasts and was left by Into the Weird Blue Yonder. Weird Blue Yonder writes, "So upset that I've finally caught up. Historically, I've avoided actual plays like the plague, but this is the fantasy podcast I didn't know I needed. The tone, world you want to dive into, and level of focus are all on point. Add in all the loving production values and manageable episode length, and what do you get? Well, it should be pretty telling that this is the only work of fiction that's ever made me tear up. Thank you very much, Weird Blue Yonder. I sometimes hear that Tale of the Manticore is the actual play for people who don't like actual plays, and I'll admit that I love to hear it because I'm kind of one of those people too. I'm also really pleased to hear that the show got you in the feels. Do people still say that? Probably not. I'm dating myself horribly now and should probably stop. I'll just say thanks very much for that awesome review." This episode features the voices of two regular guests. Playing Catsbane and Bazu are two-thirds of the Tumbledye team. Thanks very much to Kyellen and Andrew for their excellent, ongoing contributions. For listeners who would like to get in touch with me, I'm at ManticoreTale on X or Tale of the Manticore Podcast on Instagram. And there's always email, taleofthemanticore@gmail.com. Finally, I keep a blog where I post all kinds of show and RPG-related stuff. You can find it at taleofthemanticore.blogspot.com. The adventure will continue on the next episode of Tale of the Manticore, the story where chaos rolls.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Five Gems in a Trench Coat.
Excuse me?
Yeah?
What's that?
You want to know what Five Gems in a Trench Coat is? Let us tell you.
It's the adhesive that keeps the fragile pieces of my sanity together.
Well, okay, Jesse, what it actually is a narrative-driven TTRPG actual play where five friends take turns weaving stories through the tabletop game of their choice.
Of their choice?
Each season?
Each season.
That's pretty cool.
I disagree.
Oh.
I feel it's the adhesive.
So, like, you guys aren't all in a trench coat?
No, we're definitely in a trench coat.
How does that work?
Get her.
Before I'm caught, you can check out Five Gems in a Trench Coat just about anywhere you get your podcasts, or you can check out our website at fivegamesinatrenchcoat.com. Oh my god, they really are all in a trench coat.